You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Salutations, my sensual scorpions of scientific searchers of super friends. This is Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. Today's show is episode 262, and I am your humble host, Karen, and we are your blimpful of blithely blinkards blitzing blueberry blintzes.
I'm Colin.
And I'm Chris. Actually, because as somebody pointed out, I said, for some reason, I said that the year of the Simply Red album, picture book, I said 1975. I have no idea why. Holding back the years. Clearly a 1980s classic of 1980s radio. Came out in 1985. I apologize to you listeners. I apologize to Simply Red. I'm holding back. I'm holding back the years. Clearly I'm holding back the years in a lot of ways. 85.
All right, without further ado, let's jump into our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz, Hotshot. Here I have a couple random Trivial Pursuit cards. I'm just going to pick one. You guys have your barnyard buzzers. So let's jump in and answer some questions. Let's do TV.
This is
a Trivial Pursuit TV card. Before you get excited...
Too late, Karen.
The card is pretty weathered, okay, so I don't think it's current-ish TV.
All right, it was at one time accurate.
Let's jump in. Blue Wedge, what relation to Morticia Adams is Fester?
Ooh.
Okay. What relation?
Colin?
Is that niece? Do I have it right?
What relation to Morticia is Fester? Brother-in-law.
You know,
what does the card say?
The card says uncle.
Okay, no!
So the relationship.
He's Gomez's brother.
He's Gomez. He's the kid's uncle, Uncle Fester.
Well, maybe not.
Morticia's the mom. Wait, that's in the movie. Now, hold on. All right, to the internet.
I flipped the question in my mind, but I was thinking uncle and niece, right? That's what I was.
You think Uncle Fester is Morticia's uncle.
I think he's that. He's above Gomez and Morticia's generation. That's what I think.
I'm reading from Wikipedia. In the original 1960s sitcom, Fester is said to be Morticia's maternal uncle. His name rhymes with that of Morticia's mother, Hester. However, from the 1970s onward, he is Gomez's brother.
In the show.
I
think in everything. But this is specifically talking about the 1960s sitcom. He is Morticia's uncle. That is an interesting piece of trivia.
That is. Hmm. All right. Next question. Pink Wedge. What show had critic Douglas Durden raving? I quote, "This is the most important comedy show for women ever."
Oh.
Colin.
Murphy Brown.
Incorrect.
Most important comedy show for women, jumping back in time a little bit. How about, is it Kate and Allie?
No. It is The Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Okay.
Yellow Wedge. What was Detective Pepper? That's quotes. So you can figure it, listeners. Okay. All right. What was Detective Pepper Martin's real first name on Police Woman?
Oh man, that's with Angie Dickinson, right? Is that who it was?
I don't know.
What was her first name? I'll say Angie.
Oh, that's good. Yeah,
I'll say Angie.
It is Suzanne. Suzanne.
Okay. Oh,
all right. I'm guessing this card is from like early to mid 80s. That's kind of the vibe I'm getting.
You know what? I feel good. Let's keep going.
Let's do it.
Okay. All right. Next one, Brown Wedge. What kids show lampooned Star Trek with a skit called Pigs in Space, starring Captain Link Heartthrob on the Swine Trek. Chris.
That is the Muppet Show.
Love it.
All right, Green Wedge, which I'm not going to ask this question because it's kind of offensive. It was written in the past. I'm going to sub in a question here. Sub in a question, also TV related, but from a more current card. Which restaurant chain founded by Mark, Donnie, and Paul Wahlberg is the subject of an A&E television series? Chris.
Wall Tacos. No, it's Wahlbergs. Just kidding. Guy who counts all the points. I get the point. I was just kidding.
Wahlbergers. Correct. All right, we're going back to the old TV card. Right. Orange Wedge, last question. What fraction of Americans showed interest in buying TVs in 1939? Multiple choice. 13%, 26%, or 52%?
I mean, right, the rule of Kohler says choose the middle one, right?
Choose the middle yeah. one. When given three multiple choice numerical options.
I would feel like a jerk if I did not follow the advice of my good friend, Chris Kohler. But my gut says maybe a little the lowest one.
That's the thing, because it's so early. Yeah. And I mean, I can totally see a lot of people saying, you know, it's like asking people if they want to buy like a Zune or whatever. It's just like, oh, why would I want that? You know, so it's like, right. Like,
it's a interesting trivia question if it's the lowest.
It would be smart to go with the middle one. I'm gonna actually say the 13%.
All right, then I'm gonna ride along. 13.
And the answer is 13%.
Okay. All right.
Logicking over there. Woo. Yeah. All right, today's topic. So when we meet people who learn that we run a trivia podcast, we always get asked, hey, what's your favorite fact? What is your all-time favorite fact? It's so hard to answer because there are just too many. Or some people would ask us, what's your favorite segment that you did? What was your all-time favorite segment? It's like, man, we did 260 episodes. There's like multiple segments in each episode. There's like a lot. So I think a better question to ask is, what is a fact that you always think about? What is a piece of trivia from the show, whether or not it was your favorite segment or not, but it's something that you always think about or you always kind of find yourself thinking about? Do you have any of those, guys?
I often find myself thinking about the Chinese emperor who died and then was sort of Weekend at Bernie'd, you know, for as long as was needed to kind of keep things rolling smoothly. That one, I don't know why. It's like I find in my own mind ways to make analogies between that and a lot of things in life that I see.
I think about Thomas Jefferson getting roasted and canceled over the Mountain of Salt. which I think is still a really good story.
For me, this is something I think about all the time because I see it all the time. Chris, it's from your segment. It's the phenomenon of leaves falling. Leaves falling when it's fall to winter. Every time I'm out and I see dead leaves on the ground, I think of you and your segment. You know, what we think of beautiful leaves falling, the seasons are changing. It's like, no, it's leaf murder. The tree on purpose killing the leaves and pushing them off the ledge. It's leaf murder. I find myself taking walks all the time. And every time I see leaves, I think about leaf murder here, leaf murder there. And so today's episode inspired by the seasons changing. It's getting cold. So this week, let's keep warm with some winter trivia, winter facts. So this week, winter is coming. Wow, that was such a big part of my life.
And oh my gosh. Like
over.
Really? It really was. Yeah. Maybe.
No, it's over. It's,
yeah.
It'll...
yeah. Oh, okay. So Karen, I can actually, I would love to tell you, about maybe some plants, that don't, lose their leaves in the wintertime. How about that?
Yes.
A very on topic segment. This segment is called Why Japanese People Don't Like Root Beer. totally on topic for the winter themed show, why Japanese people don't like root beer. So if you know anything about Japan, it's that it is an absolute wonderland of just various different products. If you go to the soda area or the drinks area in any convenience store, you will simply be assaulted by every possible variation on everything. You can get almost anything there. You get anything in Japan, but you cannot get root beer. You cannot get a frosty glass of A&W root beer, you know, whatever, Dad's, Heinz. There's no mug. There's certainly no A&W restaurants. I cannot imagine. I mean, they got KFC in Japan. They got Taco Bell in Japan. They got Wendy's in Japan. There's no way that A&W would ever be able to open up because they are centered around a product that if you give it to, I'm not saying every Japanese person, I'm saying the vast majority.
Okay.
If you give it to them and have them drink it, very likely they've never had one in their life. And the second they taste it, they will taste it and just be like, that is disgusting. Like, that's it's not like I don't like it. It's like, that's super gross. Why would you drink that? I had a friend who back in the day lived in Japan for like 8 years, was like, dang, I can't find root beer anywhere. And then one day he went to a store that had like some Western products, and they had in a glass case some six packs of root beer. So he's like, oh, it's root beer. So he brings it, he takes it home, and then a little while, and he's saving all these bottles, you know, for like special occasions. He had a Thanksgiving party. He had people over to the house. There were Japanese people in the house. Japanese guy opens the fridge. Oh, can I have one of these beers? Oh, yeah, yeah, you can have a beer. And like the guy opens up the root beer and like he turns and he sees the guy about to take a sip of root beer. And he's like, no, slow motion. Guy, coworker, you know, takes a sip of the root beer and just makes it's just like, oh, and he just starts pouring it down the drain.
Oh, no.
He's just like, this went bad. So what's going on here? And also, what does this have to do with anything? Well, to understand this, we have to talk about a plant. We have to talk about rather a grouping of plants that are known as wintergreen.
Oh.
So you probably heard of wintergreen, like a flavor of gum or a flavor of toothpaste or lifesavers or Necco wafers or whatever. And the word wintergreen was originally used like the word evergreen to refer to like plants that were still green in the winter, like their leaves don't turn brown.
Oh,
their leaves
are
not
that
murdered.
Makes so
right?
much sense.
It does.
But the way we say now that plants in evergreen, people used to say, oh, that's a wintergreen. But now it refers more to a specific grouping of plants. And in North America, the plant that we know as wintergreen is very common in New England. It grows on the ground. It's like ground cover type plant, and it has the leaves and it has little red berries that are edible. They're called tea berries. Huh. So it's not so common anymore. If you ever heard of like tea berry pie, tea berry flavored gum,
nope.
is like an old school kind of gum you can still get.
Nope.
According to Wikipedia, and no, I did not have time to dig any further on this one, so teachers can mark me as, you know, not using a proper source, but tea berries, I just want to let you know that tea berries are also called box berries, canterberries, checkerberries, chickenberries, deerberries, gingerberries, greenberries, groundberries, grouseberries, hillberries, oneberries, spiceberries, or starberries.
That was like a Dr. Seuss book.
Yes. I think a lot of the chickenberry and the deerberry and the groundberry is all because they grow on the ground. The deer
ground
eat them because they're on the ground. Yeah. So anyway, so from wintergreen, aka the tea berry plant, you can get the tea berries, you can eat them, or you can get wintergreen oil from the leaves. And and this is the flavoring that is used to make Winto green lifesavers, and you know, that's what they call it. Yeah, and winter green toothpaste, and whatever. It's a real thing.
I think I always assumed it was just, you know, kind of marketing talk. Yeah, just branding. Yeah, I didn't.
Nope. I mean, spearmint is from literally mint, and then wintergreen is from this different type of plant. Huh. And wintergreen is considered to be like a minty flavor, but it's not mint. It's not in the mint family. It's a different type of plant.
You are
just
blowing
has
my
this
mind.
Flavorful
with these...
oil. Oh, and by the way, I want to go on a little tangent here. It has nothing to do with anything, but this is really interesting. There is a phenomenon known as triboluminescence, and that means light from friction.
Yes.
If you add friction to something, the electrons take on the energy of the friction, and when it gets released in the form of light. So if you're in a really dark room, and you take a sugar cube, and you crush a sugar cube in a dark room, and you like add that friction to it, you might actually be able to see a faint blue light appear when you crush the sugar cube, because the energy... the peanut gallery here is freaking out. So you crush it, you might actually be able to see a faint blue light when you crush the cube, right? Now, a Winto Green Lifesaver has sugar in it, but it also has wintergreen oil. And the thing with the wintergreen oil is that it's fluorescent. So if you're going into a dark room with Winto Green Lifesaver brand mouth rings and you chew it and... you're doing the triboluminescence of the glucose, that's giving off light, and that's hitting the fluorescent wintergreen oil, and you will see sparks, light sparks, when you crush it up or chew it with your mouth open, right? Yes.
Me and my sister did it.
We
read about this, and we're like, let's buy a pack, and we're just like in the corner, like eating, and be like, do you see it?
My sister and I did the same thing. Like, we had our mom buy a pack, and we went in like the closet in my sister's bedroom. We're just like, crunch, crunch, crunch. It's like, oh, I see it. Yeah. And we were probably just the mintiest two children I know, right?
Or not minty. Yeah. Winty, but you need the
speaking of good marketing and branding.
But anyway, so it turns out it's not the wintergreen alone and it's not the sugar alone, but it's together. The combination of those two things in the Winto Green Lifesaver. So the wintergreen oil, the actual science name for the wintergreen oil is methyl salicylate. Okay, methyl salicylate, okay. Right? So apart from being a flavor of gum, methyl salicylate is also, in fact, maybe you're thinking about like a recent episode in which I asked you about acetyl salicylic acid, which was more commonly known as
aspirin.
And in fact, when methyl salicylic gets into the body, it is broken down into salicylic acid, which is very similar to aspirin. It is a pain relief drug. And it's not that you necessarily take it orally, but methyl salicylate, just wintergreen oil, can be, and in fact is often used in pain relief ointments or like or those pain relief patches that you have a muscle pain on it. So it is, in fact, it is used to great extent in a pain relief brand of pain relief patch called Salonpas. I don't know if you've ever seen
Salonpas patches. Absolutely.
getting more. Yeah. Well, Salonpas was invented in 1934 in Japan. We're starting to get there. You will now not be surprised to hear that one of the key ingredients that makes root beer taste like root beer, that kind of spicy flavor, is wintergreen oil. And in the U.S., see, we kind of associate like the topical pain relief patches with like either athletes or like old people like us.
Yes,
like, oh, my back, I got to put a patch on my knee, you know, whatever. Yep. But in Japan... Salonpas patches in particular are still very, very popular among all ages of people for any kind of topical pain relief. By the way, you gotta watch out with those things because people have died because they're like, oh, I'm just gonna put a bunch of these patches on. They OD on the set on aspirin, basically, right? So you gotta watch out with that stuff. So whenever you see a YouTube video that's like, we got Japanese people to try root beer, watch the funny stuff that happens. Young people people in their, you know, teens and in their 20s are just like, oh, it tastes like a medicinal patch. It tastes like Salonpas. They don't taste the Salonpas, but it has such a powerful odor and it tastes like it smells. And that smell is highly associated with being in pain or being sick. So that is a gross smell. So when they drink the root beer, it tastes like being sick.
Triggers your just sort of your gut level, brain level reaction. Wow.
And then the weird thing is, every now and again, they find the Japanese person who loves it. So I have no, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know,
no blanket statement is going to work for everybody.
Yeah. Right.
So wintergreen oil, it's interesting stuff, and it's why Japanese people don't like root beer.
That is really amazing. I think I always assumed Salon Pass was, I don't know, French or something like that. I mean, just so many aspects of this story are just so incredible.
Jaw dropping.
Yeah.
It's like hits after hits, Chris.
Yeah.
Well, that was a tight set.
10 years into the show, more than, and still like dropping this on us.
I know. Amazing. Wow. Mm.
Crazy.
It's cold outside. And you know what? The best thing to eat when it's cold outside, you need some of that comfort, is a bowl of soup.
Yes.
Mm-mm. Mm-hmm. So here I have a quiz all about soups. Get your barnyard buzzers ready. This is a buzzin' quiz.
All right.
Most of these are pretty easy, but there's some good trivia nuggets in here. So let's jump in. In 1895, Campbell's Soup Company, introduced their first ready-to-eat soup. Mm. Back then, it was actually in a jar. It wasn't in a can. They haven't developed the can yet, but it was in a jar. What kind of soup was it?
We've had this on the show before.
What flavor was it? Bonus points if you can give me the full flavor name, Colin.
Oh, geez. Mushroom soup. Cream of mushroom.
Incorrect.
Okay.
Chris, you want to take a stab?
How about chicken noodle soup?
It is beefsteak tomato.
Mm.
Not just tomato soup, which they eventually changed to.
But beefsteak tomato. Yeah.
Beefsteak tomato.
Mm.
A good bit of marketing. Good bit of branding there.
Yep.
All right. Next question. Ding Tai Fung, or in Chinese, Ding Tai Fung, is a Chinese food restaurant based in Taipei, Taiwan. That's now a global chain. Ding Tai Fung is famous for what signature dish? Chris.
The soup dumpling.
Yes, the soup dumpling.
Xiaolongbao. They're so good. I just ate for the first time at the one in Las Vegas.
I don't know if this is true or not. From people who've eaten it in both Asia and in America, what they have said is like the soup in the soup dumpling is not as hot in the American restaurants.
That was absolutely my experience. Yep.
Okay. We all agree on this. And we understand why, right? Because the way that you eat these things, if you haven't eaten them before, is they have very hot soup inside a dumpling. So you're supposed to puncture it, let the hot soup out into a spoon, and then slurp the hot soup, and then you eat the rest of the dumpling, right? But Americans will just take the, if they got an Asian hot dumpling, pop it into their mouth,
immediately.
Boiling hot water into their mouth, and then they would sue Din Tai Fung, you know, to the ground, right?
Yep,
you're right. Here's the thing. Growing up in Taipei, Taiwan, the soup dumpling is not a particularly super remarkable thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing super extra special or anything. So how did the Din Tai Fung phenomenon blow up? We got what Colin, you said, it's in Vegas. It's in Dubai. It's in Australia. It's up here in Seattle. It's a global chain now, and it's such a big deal. And it's like, how did it get all of a sudden get so big for this item that I was just kind of like growing up? I was like, it's okay, it's fine. All thanks to Japan. So,
oh, really?
Yes, the restaurant itself. There's so many places that have soup dumplings, you know, but Din Tai Fung advertised in Japanese tourism magazines. So when tourists from Japan come to Taiwan in their travel planning, you know, literature or catalogs, they would see ads for Din Tai Fung, and they're like, oh, well, if we're going to go to Taiwan, we have to go to this traditional place
Smart.
To eat these soup Smart. Dumplings. And all of a sudden, you see this one store with a whole bunch of Japanese tourists line out the door, and you're like, wow, what's that place? And it just gained momentum from there.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that at all. Yeah.
I think when most people think about Chinese food, they think about like a hole in the wall, or they think about like Chinese takeout or delivery, whereas Din Tai Fung is like such an experience to go to the restaurant everything is so clean. Everything is so efficient.
Yeah.
The customer service is spectacular. You see the people making the dumplings in the little fish tank or, you know, like, sorry, not fish tank, but
it's called a chef tank, Karen.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Chef tank. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It's a spectacle. There's always a line.
And it's always good.
It's always good.
Consistently good. All right. Next question. Who was the host of the cult classic TV show The Soup, which recapped various pop culture moments throughout the week?
At what point?
Oh. Joel McHale.
Or Greg Kinnear.
I'm sorry, Colin. You're thinking about Talk Soup.
Okay.
Which is a different show. But yes, Joel McHale got his start hosting The Soup, which was on E! Exclamation point channel.
So great. I mean, as much as people like him on Community, I think that was his best thing that he ever did. He was perfect for that role.
And children, for those of you who don't know what The Soup is, it is a kind of pre-internet, I guess, a show would take all of the crazy, insane moments of reality TV or normal TV and then kind of do a commentary over it. Back then, it was a very novel idea. And Joel McHale was great. Next question. Soldiers coming back from World War II might have helped popularize the grilled cheese sandwich, but it is in American public schools where it got paired with what? Chris.
I have to guess tomato soup.
Yeah.
Correct. Tomato soup. Because of vitamin C. So they would serve the processed cheese, grilled cheese, and be like, we need something moderately healthy to go with it. So let's give them some tomato soup, which happens to have vitamin C.
Mm-hmm. Perfect, perfect marriage of flavors. Thanks, lunch ladies.
Next question. Miso soup, a mainstay in Japanese cuisine, is made of soup stock, additions like seaweed and tofu, and of course, miso. What exactly is miso? Chris.
Fermented soybeans.
Yes, correct. It is fermented soybean paste. Importantly, it is soybeans. Like, actually, they get a bunch of beans, inoculate the soybeans with a special fungus, and it's called koji. In Japanese, it's called koji, which is a special strain of fungus. Next soup question. What is the key difference between gazpacho and most other soups? Colin.
Gazpacho is typically served cold.
Cold. Not good for winter. Cold. Have you guys had gazpacho?
I love a good gazpacho. Ooh. Yeah, I really do.
I've had ketchup right out of the bottle. Is that...
So gazpacho is Andalusian, which is Andalusian is the region of south of Spain. But yes, you had the Americano version of gazpacho.
Americano version of gazpacho.
All right, next question. Kakaliki.
Yeah.
Kakaliki is a soup hailing from Scotland. What are the two main ingredients of kakaliki?
Oh, this could go so many directions.
Chris.
I would have to say probably chicken and leeks.
Correct. It is chicken and leeks. Kakaliki. Yeah. Fun to say. Kakaliki. All right. The three main aromatic herbs in Thai soup, tom yum, we love a good tom yum, is lemongrass, kefir lime leaves, and galangal. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing it wrong. Galangal. Mm-hmm. Galangal. Lemongrass is grass. Kefir lime leaves are leaves from the kefir lime plant. Mm-hmm. What is galangal? Colin.
Is it a root like a ginger or something sort of like? Okay.
Yes, it is. I mean, I was looking for ginger. It's not exactly ginger, but it's in the ginger family. Mm. And for a long time, I thought it was like a fruit, but it is a hunk of root that looks like ginger. That's what galangal is. All right, next question. This is a hard one. In the Pixar film Ratatouille, in the movie's climax, Remy the rat prepares ratatouille, a French vegetable stew, for the food critic. What was the food critic's name?
Oh, God. Oh,
man.
Just rewatch this too.
I saw this not too long ago.
Who was he voiced by? I think he was voiced by Peter O'Toole.
God.
Let's see.
Goodness.
Did it start with an M?
No.
No.
His name is Anton Ego.
Oh, right. Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Yes.
Who was the voice actor? Hold on. Peter O'Toole. Wow. Good job, Brain.
Good job, Brain.
Pull that out. Oof. Oh. Last question in the soup quiz. New England clam chowder is white, cream-based.
Yes.
We talked about this on the show before. Manhattan clam chowder is red, tomato-based. What do you call it when you combine the two into a pinkish chowder?
What?
Chris.
New Jersey clam chowder.
your logic is on the right track.
Thank you.
It is called the Long Island clam chowder.
Oh my gosh.
Because it's somewhere, it's a place between New England and Manhattan.
Oh my gosh. A Long Island clam chowder is made with rum, gin, vodka,
151.
Heavy cream clams,
and
then you float, and then you float the 151 and oyster crackers.
And then you set it on fire.
Right. Yeah. And then you set it on fire, and then you throw it in the garbage.
Oh my god! Someone should have like Long Island night where you drink Long Island clam chowder and Long Island iced tea.
Put down some tarps first. Yeah.
Time to compose myself. All right, time to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall rock climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
You're listening to Good Job Brain. Smooth puzzles, smart trivia. Good Job Brain.
With the theme of winter and wintry facts, I have enjoyed assembling for you two a grab bag quiz about all things wintry, cold, icy, frozen, snowy, Christmassy, what have you. This will be a write-down quiz. Why don't you each get something to write with? And the name of this quiz is Winter by the Numbers. And every question in this quiz will have a numeric answer. So for every question, it is going to be closest to the mark, gets the point. Some of them will be years. Some of them will be measurements. Some of them will be various other things. So here we go. First question. How tall, and I'll do the unit conversion for you, okay? How tall is the current Guinness World Record holder for world's tallest snow person?
Wow.
Like assisted or unassisted? You know
right,
what I mean?
Right,
like
right.
Someone with like a rebar structure underneath dousing water.
Yeah, right. Yeah. What I mean, you know, what effort are you going to put into to make it into the Guinness book? You decide what units you want to give me.
All right.
Answers up. Okay. Karen says 80 feet.
Oh.
Chris says 52 feet. Mm. I like the specificity. Karen takes the point. You both underestimated the current record holder for world's tallest snow person. She is, in fact, a snow woman. It is in the town of Bethel, Maine. In 2008, they built a 122-foot tall snow person. With substantial amount of assistance. This was not just some kids getting some snow together in the backyard. Yeah. Right. No, this is amazing. The townspeople and people from surrounding towns as well built a snow woman over the period of 1 month. This snow woman is only a little bit shorter than the Statue of Liberty. I mean, just to put this in context. Yes, the statue herself, as Chris has talked about before on the show, the pedestal makes her seem, more imposing. But this, 122 feet, 1 inch, in fact. Her name is Olympia. Olympia, the Snow Woman. This is a direct sort of homage to Senator Olympia Snow, who was Senator of Maine from 95 to 2013. Wow. I mean, 122 feet tall. Yeah. Her eyelashes were made of 8 pairs of skis. This thing is just giant.
Oh, okay.
Her arms were trees. Her arms were 2 30-foot tall spruce trees just wedged in on the side. I mean, these are not twigs for arms. If you're looking at pictures online, and I encourage you to do so, it's not like 3 balls, right? Kind of the classic American snowman. Because to make something 122 feet tall safely, she's basically sort of a gently sloping tall pyramid, mean, it's
she's an inverted funnel.
She is a cone, more or less. But yeah, very impressive. Gosh. Her scarf is 130 feet long. She has lips made from 5 red car tires, kind of stuck in a smile there. Just truly incredible feat of gumption. By
I wrote down 100 feet and I was just like, no, there's no way somebody would know. But I underestimated people's ability here.
That just 10 years prior to her debut, there was another mega snow person, a snowman in Bethel, Maine. In 1999, Bethel, Maine introduced Angus, King of the Mountain, who was 113 feet tall. So the proud people of Bethel, Maine have a rich tradition of these, gargantuan snow people. Yeah. It might be downhill from here after Olympia, the 122 foot tall snow woman, but we'll see where we can go. All right, moving right along. Next question. At the beginning of the novel, A Game of Thrones, George R.R. Martin, how old is the character Jon Snow?
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. As you guys know, it is different from the TV show, but how different? All right, answers up. You have both answered 14. You both got it right on the nose. You got it.
Okay, all right.
He was indeed 14 years old at the beginning of the book. On the HBO TV series, they made him slightly older. They said he was 16.
It's hard living. It's a hard living 16,
Next question. Every year around this time, millions of Americans turn on their TVs to watch a beloved holiday story about the protagonist's seasonal depression and disillusionment with capitalism. I'm talking, of course, about A Charlie Brown Christmas. A beloved staple of American TV, premiered on CBS. What year?
Wow.
What year did A Charlie Brown Christmas first air? Has aired every year since then.
Sure.
Ooh, okay. My sister was born.
The show was a smash hit despite being considered a gamble for CBS. They were pretty reluctant to air it, in fact, at first. Answers up. Chris says 1966. Karen says 1978. Ooh. Chris, 1 year off, December 1965. Wow, yeah, I really had no idea. I mean, looking back, it seems like such an obvious hit now, but CBS passed on the pitch at first. They really, it was kind of just untested and unproven. They didn't think there was going to be a big market for it. They really had, there was a lot of cajoling to get this thing made at all. I mean, even I guess right up in, until airtime, even the executives were really kind of like,
whoa,
let's just get this thing out there. We're kind of like contractually obligated to run it and then just move on. Nearly half of TV viewers in the country tuned in to watch it. Yeah.
They love it Snoopy.
I mean, look, every year since then, it has definitely proven that. All right, moving right along. What is the coldest temperature recorded in U.S. history?
Oh my gosh.
I will even offer you a bonus point for the state that this temperature was recorded.
Oh my
coldest
gosh,
temperature okay. recorded in U.S. history.
Oh, wow.
This dates to 1971.
It's negative.
Will tell you it is negative. Yes, it is negative. In fact, all but one of our great states has experienced a sub-zero temperature. Yes. Okay. Answers up.
Oh.
Karen says negative 52 degrees Fahrenheit and Alaska. Chris says negative 42 degrees Fahrenheit and Alaska. Karen gets 2 points because it is indeed Alaska. And the lowest temperature ever recorded there was negative 80 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
Yes. Yes. That was, January 1971, Prospect Creek, Alaska, negative 80. It is interesting. I was looking at this at the records for every state here. And well, you guys, maybe you can guess here. Think about it. Well, like what state do you think has not experienced a sub-zero temperature?
It is
Hawaii. That's right. Yeah. The lowest temperature on record for Hawaii is a balmy 12 degrees Fahrenheit, dating to 1979. It's pretty cold for Hawaii. Yeah. The coldest temperature in the contiguous U.S., not far off, negative 70 degrees Fahrenheit in Rogers Pass, Montana. Yeah. So we're not lagging too far behind. Mm. Yeah. Now, again, it only has to hit these temperatures once. Not saying it does this all the time. Mm. All right. Well, when you get temperatures that low, -2, -3, -4, -70, -80, wherever you fall in there, depending on where you live, you will very likely encounter frozen lakes and frozen ponds. According to the National Weather Service, what is the minimum safe thickness of ice to drive a car across?
No.
There are guidelines for how safe it is to walk across. One person, you know,
no,
snowmobiles.
It's gotta be all right. Like, it's gotta be like.
All right. I love that we got the West Coast
what?
People here answering this question. All right. Karen, I love the range here. All right. Karen says 20 inches. And Chris says 10 feet. Chris, you are indeed extremely conservative on that side.
Yeah.
Most sources say you need at least 8 inches of ice to be safe.
To drive a car across it?
To drive a car. 8 to 12 is kind of the range at which it's, but 8 would be on the absolute lowest end, according to the National Weather Service. Yeah, to drive a car. I'm sure listeners out there who know more than I do about this laughing at my naivete. But yeah, I mean, growing up in Los Angeles, this was not ever a concern of mine. I mean, you don't want your car anywhere near a lake at any time of the year. I learned some interesting stuff about this. Like, well, so for one, the safest ice is the newest ice, just new, clear, the most integrity. You want to avoid the older, slushier, cloudier ice. It's not going to be as strong. You can walk on ice safely, starting, you know, around 4 inches even. And you can ride, you know, a snowmobile starting around 5 inches or so. So yeah, it really has a lot of integrity. Now, lakes and ponds are much safer than rivers.
Sure.
Maybe for obvious reasons, because there's no current underneath. Yeah, right. You know, don't count on Good Job Brain for survival tips here.
This is for entertainment only. Do not drive your car out on a frozen lake and be like, the podcast told me to do it. Honey, does this look like about 8 inches ice to you? How many inches would you say this is?
All right, point to Karen, closest to there with the 20 inches to 8. Yeah. 10 feet.
I thought you had spinal tapped it for a second. I'm like, oh, Karen, she put the little inch marker. She must be feet, you know? No, you're right.
All right. Sticking with adventure and danger here. We'll see how conservative maybe your guess is here, Chris. How many people have reached the summit of Mount Everest?
Oh.
Now, of course, this is according to the best records. This is...
Mm-hmm. Okay.
How many people... According to the Himalayan database, in fact. Yeah, I won't give you any hints here one way or the other, but yeah, we have a pretty good idea. A lot of people have attempted. A lot of people bail out. I mean, regretfully, a lot of people have perished doing this. How many people have successfully completed the trip to the summit of Mount Everest?
To the very top. All right, to the very top.
Mm-hmm.
Are we counting Sherpas?
We're counting every single human being who has been up there. Yep. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Karen says 815. Chris says 5,000. Again, I love seeing the spread here. This is great. What I hope for with these quizzes. Chris gets the point. As of January 2023, the best number that I could find is 6,338 people. Yeah, definitely more than I would have guessed. I would have guessed in the hundreds too before I did a little bit of research on this. Let's transition to a safer activity somewhat. Each winter season, more than 100,000 New Yorkers and tourists from around the world visit the Rockefeller Center ice skating rink. Features prominently in many TV shows, many movies over the years. What year did the Rockefeller Center ice skating rink open? I will tell you, it was a hit right away.
Rockefeller.
Yeah. I mean, you might know when the building and the plaza were completed. That might help you pin it down a little bit.
Nope.
Maybe not.
No, I sure don't.
All right. Let's see your answers. Chris says 1903. Karen says 1883. Chris is closer. You both a little bit early here, substantially. It opened to the public on Christmas Day, 1936. Yeah, later than I would have guessed as well. Yeah, so 1936, point to Chris there. It was temporary at first, you know, so prior to the ice rink being there, it was definitely not part of the original vision. It was sort of an open plaza with, you know, there was some retail space. It was not particularly popular, it sounds like. And they kind of just figured, let's try something here sort of maybe and see how it goes for the holiday season in 1936. Yeah, like I say, immediate hit. New Yorkers loved it. And it became clear that they had to bring it back the next year and the next year and the next year. In 1939, it was upgraded to a permanent installation of a 120-by-60-foot rink. My impression of it the first time I went there was it seems so much smaller than it looks like on TV and movies. Like you get out there, it's like, oh, wow, it's very intimate and kind of cozy out there.
The Nintendo store is across the street, right?
It is. That's where I go.
It's pretty big in there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we are all tied up here. 5-5.
Oh, gosh.
Yes. This is exciting here, unless I goofed in the scorekeeping. But let's just go with this. We're tied up. Bear with me a little bit on this last question. Maybe a little sideways thinking involved here, but still in line with our numeric quiz. And we'll plug a good cause here. So as you may know, the United States Postal Service runs a yearly program named USPS Operation Santa. And this is a program where children and families can send an official letter to Santa Claus. And for many years, the Postal Service would accept letters just simply addressed to Santa Claus, North Pole. And they would have sort of an unofficial official policy of employees could answer them if they wanted to. Oh. They could pass them on to other groups if they wanted to answer kids. Very often, very legitimate wishes for things, you know? And over time, this got formalized.
Whoa.
In fact, now it's become a very well-run kind of gift exchange, or, you know, almost like a charity program that, you know, so the Postal Service will select a number of these candidate letters each year, and they will match people with gift givers. So, as I mentioned, once upon a time, you could just write, you know, Santa Claus, North Pole, and there's a very good chance that your letter would end up somewhere. So a few years ago, they assigned an official address that you should use for Santa Claus when you are sending your letters as part of Operation Santa. Now, the street address, if you will, is 123 Elf Road, the North Pole. And my question to you is, what is the zip code for Operation Santa? I will tell you only that it is a valid U.S. zip code, at least in terms of it following the rules of what zip codes need to be. Even though it's a zip code, we'll go with closest to, as if we were approximating a value.
Never mind. I thought I was clever.
Okay. Well, no, you should be clever. I want to encourage you guys to just kind of see where your brains go with this one. It's a zip code that might be appreciated by Olympia the Snow Woman.
It is cryptic.
Chris says 040404. Oh, I like it. Like ho 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 upside down. That's great.
Yeah.
Karen, however, has nailed it with 88888. Yes, it is 123 Elf Road, North Pole, 88888. And I saw snowmen. That. I'm like, oh, that's so cute. There's snowmen. There's snow people, right? How clever. I looked into it. It turns out, no, actually, it's not necessarily to resemble snowmen. It's kind of just a general purpose administrative zip code that the post
is for. That's easy to write.
It works so well. 88888. Yeah, well, Karen, well done. All right. You know your winter. Winter is coming. Good job.
Very good.
Good job, Brain. Nice.
And the moral of the quiz is snow woman, snow cry.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
All right, I have our last winter segment, and travel back in time with me. This is 1992. I was in third grade. I'm in the nurse's office, the nurse's room at school, unwilling to look at anybody. I'm just trying to like disappear into the wall, into this corner, facing the corner. Very recently, we had an episode about embarrassment, and I talked about what is called an involuntary memory, which colloquially we call it a cringe attack. It is a memory of something that is so embarrassing that happened in your life, and for some reason, your brain holds on to it, and when you least expect it, the memory will appear, and it will make you cringe, right? It's a cringe attack. And the interesting thing about this is it's so embarrassing that it made your brain remember it, like remember all of these details very vividly. So this is a cringe attack memory. So I'm standing. So I just remember everything. I remember I was wearing a dark pink sweater. I had my pink glasses. I'm just staring in this corner being like, oh my God, please, can I please disappear? So this happened back in Taiwan. Taiwan is a relatively hot country. But the winters can get chilly. It's one of those things where the winter hits one day, the temperature just drops and you're like, oh, okay, it's winter now. Just before I got to the nurse's room, I was outside at recess. And this is one of those days when the temperature dropped. This guy, I even remember his name, Teddy Chi. He was on top of the play structure at recess. So he was like high up there and he looks down. He sees me. He points his finger at me and yelled, "Karen's face is about to explode." My next memory is I'm in the nurse's room. So why was I there? Why was I hiding in the corner? Why is my face about to explode? What's happening? So I didn't know it at the time, but I had a rare case of cold urticaria.
Huh.
Huh.
Cold urticaria. The skin has an abnormal reaction to cold.
Oh my gosh.
I was legitimately allergic to cold.
Wow.
It was something that happened to me. If I get out of the swimming pool, I will get it. When it's really cold, I will get it. And this is what's actually happening. My skin will start getting little bumps, not flea bites, little bug bites.
Yeah.
Right? A bunch of little bumps. Then they start to get itchy. Then they start swelling up like welts. And the bumps grow into bigger bumps and they start growing together. It's like splotchy. I felt like I was a mutant. You know, I was 10 years old. I was like, this is happening. I'm like going to morph into a lizard.
Holy moly.
I didn't know at the time that this is a rare case. So, you know, let's back up. Sometimes maybe you find yourself in the rain. Maybe you're like out cycling in the cold or you're walking somewhere. You come back home and it's warm and your skin might feel a little bit red, maybe a little bit itchy,
when it's
long exposure to cold. So that's like a mild case of cold urticaria.
Oh my God.
So you're like mildly allergic to this cold. But I had a case where I was growing hives. I was legitimately growing hives.
And was it painful? I mean, is it?
It's itchy. Okay. It's itchy and it's painful in that a kid at the playground told me that my face was going to explode.
It's emotionally painful.
Emotionally. Yeah.
My gosh.
You know, I don't know if he did it as like making fun or he was like actually concerned.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a very early episode of Good Job Brain, we talked about the science of sneezing. Right? Like sometimes when you sneeze, this is how you stop sneezing, or you need to facilitate a sneeze. What do? People tell you to look at the light, right? Because your sneeze nerve in your face is very close to your optic nerve in your face. So if you trigger the optic nerve, it will kind of like stimulate the sneezing nerve. And so I had that too. So, you know, every time I wake up and I'm in the sunshine, I'll start sneezing. And my dad used to joke around and be like, "Oh, you're allergic to the sun." But, you know, it wasn't a joke to me. I thought I was legitimately allergic to the sun because it made me sneeze every day. So now I'm 10. I'm allergic to the sun and I'm allergic to the cold.
I can't win.
You can't live on the earth.
I was like having an existential crisis. Like, am I X-Men? I don't know.
Yeah. When do the cool powers kick in?
Yeah. But now I know this is cold urticaria.
So what can you do to prevent it?
It is just a very intense allergic reaction.
Wow.
Right. So like your cells have histamines and you know, when this is triggered, the histamine kind of bursts out of cells.
So could you like would an antihistamine, I mean, just like any other kind of histamine attack help or, you know?
Yeah, but no one gave me any back then.
Right.
I mean, I can drink cold water. Some people are so allergic that, you know, having ice cubes on their skin would trigger this, or drinking cold water would trigger some sort of allergic reaction. I mean, that's a super, super extreme.
Wow.
If you ever experience this, don't feel alone. I'm there with you.
You know, we're humans. A lot of things are on spectrums. My wife, you know, this hasn't happened in a while, but it used to be a recurring thing where every winter, like her legs would just get really itchy. And persistently, and you know, like we would even call it the winter itchies, and it was just like almost some years were worse than others, but it there's sometimes dry when skin. It was almost hive like. I wonder if this is on the same continuum.
Cold urticaria. It's weird.
Yeah.
Sounds like a Game of Thrones character.
I know.
Sir, S-E-R. Yeah. And I'll end on this. This is one of those facts earlier in the show. This is a fact I think about all the time. I think it was in Dana's segment. We had a camping episode. And she talked about how you have to go, when you're camping, you have to go pee before you go to sleep.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, for
sure. Otherwise, you just have pee in your body that your body's wasting energy trying to keep warm, and keep hot.
That's right.
Oh.
Yep.
Every time I wake up in the middle of the night to go pee, I think about that.
You're like, I'm going to come back to bed and be a little bit warmer.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff happened on this episode.
Yeah, what a trip this episode.
Yeah.
Really covering the corners.
That's our show. Thank you all for joining me, and thank you, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned stuff about root beer, about tallest snow people, about soup, and about cold hives. You can find us on all major podcast apps and on our website, goodjobbrain.com. This podcast is part of Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to other shows like Reach, the space podcast for kids, The Ancient World, and IGN Movies. And we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Spend less time staying in the know about all things gaming and more time actually watching and playing what you want with the IGN Daily Update podcast. All you need is a few minutes to hear the latest from IGN on the world of video games, movies, and television with news, previews, and reviews. So listen and subscribe to the IGN Daily Update wherever you get your podcasts. That's the IGN Daily Update wherever you get your podcasts.